Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're looking at a set of sources you sent over about one of the most ambitious and just logistically insane sagas in exploration history. We're talking about the two massive Russian expeditions led by Vitus Jonas and Bering.
And our mission, really, for this deep dive is to get into the sheer audacity of it all. I mean, Bering's name is everywhere, right? The Bering Sea, the Strait, Bering Island. But his fame, it isn't just about the sailing. It's about the unbelievable human and financial machine he had to build just to get his ships into the water in the first place.
He's the one who basically defined the boundary between Asia and North America for the rest of the world. But here's the real hook, I think. He was a Danish guy, a naval officer for Russia, chosen by Tsar Peter I. And the prep for his journeys, it meant moving thousands of men and tons of supplies across 6,000 miles of, you know, total wilderness. The logistics completely dwarfed the actual exploring part.
Exactly. And that's the thing. To understand why such a gargantuan effort was even necessary, we have to look at the man himself, you know? What kind of person do you even pick to lead what was essentially a national obsession that went on for more than a decade?
Okay, so let's unpack that. Bering. He's born in Horsens, Denmark in 1681. He starts super young, becomes a ship's boy at just 15, sailing all the way to India and the Dutch East Indies. Then he gets his naval training in Amsterdam, which positions him perfectly for a power like Russia that's, you know, on the rise.
Right. Peter the Great was modernizing his navy at a breakneck pace, and he needed skilled foreigners. Bering was perfect. He joins the Russian Navy in 1704 as a sub-lieutenant and spends years in these, well, kind of unglamorous logistical roles during the Great Northern War, but that's probably what shaped his entire command style, you know? By 1720, he's a second captain.
But this next part, this is where you see the man, this sort of shrewd operator he was. In 1724, he gets promoted to first captain, and then what does he do? He immediately retires. And the reason why, it's not because he was tired of the sea.
No, not at all. It's this fantastic bit of social climbing. Bering's wife, Anna, she was connected to a powerful naval family, and her younger sister marries a rear admiral who had less time in service than Bering. That was a huge slight back then. So Bering basically leverages his own retirement to get the higher rank of first captain, save face, and protect his wife's social standing.
So he quits out of social embarrassment
mm-hmm.
and then just rejoins the Navy a few months later, but keeps that higher rank.
Yep.
I mean, that kind of strategic thinking, that ability to work the system, it suggests he was the perfect guy to handle the Russian bureaucracy he was about to face.
He absolutely needed it, and he rejoined just in time. Late 1724, Tsar Peter I signs the orders for the first Kamchatka expedition. The mission seems simple on paper. Sail north from Kamchatka, keep land on your left, and see if it eventually turns west. Prove Asia and America are separate.
Right. And here's the question I kept asking myself. Why start in St. Petersburg? If you're sailing from Kamchatka, why this 6,000-mile land journey first? Why not just send a ship around the Cape?
Because they just didn't know. The maps of the time were, well, they were rudimentary at best. The Russian government didn't know for sure where the Pacific ended or where Kamchatka even was on a global map. They had to chart the overland route first to make sure they could transport all the heavy gear, the naval specialists, the iron fittings for the ships they knew they'd have to build from scratch when they got there.
So he leaves in February 1725. The initial party is just 34 men, including his two lieutenants, Spanberg and Chirikov. But that number seems low.
It was a fantasy. As soon as they started moving east, they had to take on more men, more supplies, draft laborers. The party just kept swelling. We have records where they request 60 carpenters just for small repairs along the way. This wasn't a hike. It was a small army on the move.
And the land itself was just monstrous. They're crossing rivers using sledges, literally building roads across marshland. I mean, the pace of the journey alone tells you how hard it was.
Spanberg's supply boats, which were loaded down and going upstream, were moving at about 1 mile a day, sometimes less. You're spending years just fighting the terrain, blizzards, waist-high snow. It's a constant battle.
And the trip to the port of Okhotsk took years. It led to some really desperate, tragic moments.
Yes. By the time they get to Okhotsk, his men are starving, and this is where the mission's logistics just brutally collide with reality. To save his men, to stop the whole mission from collapsing, Bering had to seize flour from the local villagers.
Which solved his problem in the short term. But
it caused starvation for the people who actually live there. It's a really stark reminder that these grand imperial projects were often built on the suffering of the local people whose lands they crossed.
Definitely. So by the time Bering finally gets to the lower Kamchatka post, he's already spent 3 years traveling 6,000 miles just to get to the starting line.
The logistics were the main event.
Okay, so after all that, they build the ship, the St. Gabriel, and they finally set sail in July 1728. They go northeasterly, enter the strait we now call the Bering Strait, and they see the land turn west. So, mission accomplished, right?
Almost, but not quite. On August 13th, the ice is moving in fast, and Bering makes this critical decision to turn back. He correctly figured that there was open sea between the continents, which fulfilled Peter's literal instructions.
But we never actually saw America.
Exactly. He didn't deliver that visual, undeniable proof.
So he gets back in 1730. He's awarded 1,000 rubles, promoted to Captain Commodore, which is a big deal.
Huh.
But that lack of definitive proof just sets the stage for something much, much bigger.
And that something much bigger is the Great Northern Expedition. It basically turns the first mission into a practice run. Bering immediately proposes a second voyage. This time, the goal is explicit. Find North America, map the Arctic coast. And this is where the scale goes from staggering to just insane.
It really does. The initial core staff was supposed to be around 600 people.
But once you add in all the support staff, the laborers, carpenters, blacksmiths, soldiers, the number balloons to nearly 3,000 people. This wasn't an expedition anymore. It was a mobile town crossing Siberia.
And with that size comes massive scope creep. Suddenly the goals are, you know, map the whole Arctic coast, find a route to Japan, explore trade with Spanish America. The cost must have been astronomical.
If you look at the numbers, the difference is just stunning. The initial budget for the second expedition was set at 12,000 rubles. The final, true cost, 300,000 rubles.
300,000. To put that in context, that single expense was probably equal to the entire annual cost of several major naval ships combined. I mean, it was a financial black hole.
Yeah.
The sources say it caused widespread poverty in the whole region they were moving through.
It did. And the logistics became political. The delays just kept mounting because the scale was overwhelming. Bering himself gets bogged down in a place called Yakutsk until 1737, just dealing with supplies and the political fallout from the cost. It even hit him personally. His own salary was cut in half because the timeline had just completely gone out the window.
But because of that scale, they also attracted some of the best minds.
Yeah.
Right? There was a whole academic wing to this expedition. They had a natural historian, Johann Georg Melanin, an anthropologist, Gerhard Friedrich Müller, and an astronomer, Louis de Lille de la Croyère.
And they weren't just along for the ride. Their job was to systematically map everything, record the climate, catalog plants and animals, document the local peoples. They were basically running a mobile university in the middle of a war-level logistical effort. It was an incredible scientific undertaking.
And while Bering is stuck in that bureaucratic mud in Yakutsk, his subordinates are still out there making history.
That's where Spanberg comes back in. He leads this key detachment that sails south, builds three ships, and makes two voyages that result in the first Russian landing in Japan. So the Great Northern Expedition wasn't just one thing. It was this coordinated imperial push happening on multiple fronts at once.
Incredible. So finally, the main event, the mission to America, is ready. Spring of 1741, Bering leaves from Avacha Bay in Kamchatka. He's on the St. Peter, his second in command, Jurikov, is on the St. Paul, and they even named the new settlement they founded there, Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky, after their two ships.
And the breakthrough comes pretty fast. They achieve their main goal on July 16, 1741. Bering sights the huge volcano Mount St. Elias and makes a landing on what was probably Kayak Island, America. They found it.
But then, almost immediately, it all goes wrong. A storm separates the two ships, and now you have two different tragic stories unfolding. Chirikov, on the St. Paul, discovers the coast of Northwest America near the Alexander Archipelago. But Bering's return journey is just a complete nightmare.
It is. But before the disaster, we have to mention the science. On that landing, the naturalist Jorb Steller was. Well, he was a force of nature. He was documenting everything like a madman, identifying species no European had ever seen. The Steller sea cow, the Steller's jay. They're named after him for a reason.
But Steller's journals also show us the darker side of this, right? They give us these really difficult insights into the human cost.
Yeah, Steller was a very ethical scientist for his time.
Yeah.
And his writings record the horrifying treatment of the native people they encountered. He specifically documents his own detachment, torturing captured Koryak people. He even lodged formal complaints about it.
And those complaints, just like earlier complaints about the expedition's delays, were just suppressed by the command. It really shows the tension, doesn't it? It's officially a mission of science and discovery, but underneath, it's often just brutal imperial expansion.
And the return voyage is where the tragedy is really sealed. Bering himself gets incredibly sick. The thinking at the time was scurvy, but later analysis suggests it was probably heart failure from all the stress and malnutrition. He eventually has to pass command to Sven Waxel.
He's still technically in command, though, when he names the Shumagin Islands after a sailor who died and was buried there. A grim way to make the map.
Very. In November 1741, the St. Peter is wrecked on an uninhabited island in the Commander Islands. Bering dies there on December 19th at 60 years old, along with 28 of his men. The island is now, rightly, called Bering Island.
But the story doesn't end there, which might be the most incredible part. Of the 77 men on that ship, 46 survived the wreck.
And what they did next is just a testament to their skill. They spent months on this desolate island, and they built a new, smaller boat from the wreckage of the St. Peter, and they sailed it home in August 1742.
Only to find out the most agonizing truth. Chertkov had actually mounted a rescue mission for them, but had missed them by just a few miles.
A profound sacrifice after all that effort. So we come back to the legacy. Bering's name is famous, but he wasn't the first to do these things. Semyon Dezhnev went through the strait 80 years earlier. Another explorer sighted North America in the 1730s. So what makes Bering different?
It's the scale, like we've been saying. It's the system. Those earlier voyages were individuals or small groups. Bering's expeditions were systematic, government-funded, massive undertakings that confirmed the geography for the world.
Exactly. His work gave us comprehensive, systematic mapping of eastern Siberia, the North Pacific, and that final confirmation of the separation of the continents. That enormous organizational effort and the huge body of knowledge it produced, that's why his name is on the map.
It's a story of just incredible human effort, massive ambition, and astronomical cost that redrew the map of the world. The cost was devastating, but the geographical truth was delivered.
And here's a final thought for you to take away. Despite all this incredible scientific work, the charts, the catalogs, Steller's detailed records, Bering's reports were initially classified. They were jealously guarded by the Russian government.
They locked the knowledge away.
For over a century. The full story of the Great Northern Expedition wasn't shared with the world. So imagine how different the history of Arctic exploration would be if all that critical knowledge had been available immediately. Other fundamental knowledge gathered at such immense cost might still be locked away by nations today, preventing all of us from getting a more complete picture of our own world.